This is the Global News podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and in the early hours of Sunday the 9th of March, these are our main stories. Iran's supreme leader rejects a demand from Donald Trump to reach a nuclear deal with the US or face a potential military response. Poland's prime minister says overnight Russian air attacks on Ukraine are a result of appeasing a barbarian. Shock and fear in Syria's minority Alawite community, as more than 600 civilians are reported to have been killed by Syria's security forces. Also in this podcast, South Korea's impeached president gets out of jail. And International Women's Day, through the prism of Spain.
We are still being killed. There are many things that need to keep changing. I don't want to see the upcoming generation going through what the previous generations and even us have gone through.
Iran has responded defiantly to President Trump's warning that it faces possible military action unless it agrees to nuclear talks. Mr. Trump says he told the Ayatollah in a letter that Iran must never be allowed to become a nuclear power and could face attack. The Islamic Republic's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Iran would not negotiate under pressure from what he called a bullying country.
Some bully governments insist on negotiations, but these talks are not aimed at solving problems. Instead, they want to use them to dominate others. By all means, let's negotiate, but let's do so to push for what we want. If the parties sitting on the other side of the table accept, all the better. If they don't, they will take the blame.
Tehran has repeatedly denied that it's planning to develop nuclear weapons, but has enriched its uranium supplies to near weapons-grade level. Parham Gabadi from the BBC's Persian service told me more.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei was furious today. He called the United States a bully, a country that is bullying Iran and is trying to come to a deal with Iran through intimidation. He did not lash out at the United States. He also targeted European countries as well, the three European countries, United Kingdom, France and Germany, the signatories of Iran nuclear deal, called them, said that these countries are shameless because they're asking Iran to stick to its nuclear commitments. So he was extremely angry. But this is, let's remember that this is not the first time that Donald Trump has sent a letter to Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei back in 2019 during his first term after giving up the nuclear deal. He also sent a letter to Khamenei through Shinzo Abe, late Japanese prime minister. And at that time, Khamenei gave the same response. He said that it was not worthy. His letter is not worthy a response. And in front of the cameras, he did not even agree to accept the letter.
What's at stake for Iran if it refuses President Trump's demand for a deal?
So a lot of things have changed since President Trump's first term, because last time the tension was not this high between Iran and Israel. So Iran and Israel have targeted each other, directly attacked each other twice at least in the past few months. So that has changed. The other thing that has changed is that in the past few years, Iran has seen several rounds of nationwide protests, both because of social grievances and economic grievances. And those grievances are still there today. All this pressure is going to be even more if Donald Trump is going to be able to reduce Iranian oil export to zero. So there is a risk for Iranian supreme leader to face a nationwide protest. Plus, apart from that, this time it's real. President Trump has said that he probably does not want to get the United States involved in another war in the Middle East. But he has previously said that he's going to give the green light to Israelis to strike Iran's nuclear facilities. And from the reports, we know that Iran's anti-air defense systems, which protect Iran's nuclear facilities, have been damaged last time Israel attacked Iran.
So how concerned will the Iranian government be at this escalation in tension?
The rhetorics show that they rebuff the threat. They say that they are not really that concerned. They've already resisted in the past, so they are going to resist more. However, this time the stakes are really high for Iran, because Israel has already launched an attack against Iran in the past, so they've shown that they're capable of doing that. And if that happens again, that can risk a further escalation. If Iran responds, that can spiral out of control and turn out to be a full-blown war.
Parham Gabbardi. Now to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Fighting is intensifying in the Ukraine-held Kursk region. Ukraine's military says it was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting in over 100 clashes on Saturday, after Russian attacks killed at least 25 people overnight. The escalation follows the US limiting Ukraine's access to its military intelligence and satellite imagery. Major Vladimir Omelyan, a former Ukrainian minister of infrastructure now serving on the front line, says this has crippled Ukraine's ability to anticipate Russian attacks.
Using this intelligence, using satellites, we are able to foresee Russian Red Army actions, to understand what kind of supplies they provide to the front line, to understand what kind of attacks they already doing. By cutting that, we become almost blind. We still have some access to our own surveillance, but it's mainly short, mid-range. You cannot prevail or you cannot destroy the enemy if you don't understand its actions.
America's shifting stance on Ukraine has caused grave concern in Europe. Neighbouring Poland has already announced military training for all adult men this week. And its Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, said this latest attack is what happens when you appease barbarians. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
It was the turn of the town of Dobropilia to feel the weight of another Russian drone attack. 8 apartment blocks, people's homes were damaged or destroyed. There are casualties and injuries, says Pavlo Dierchenko from the local police. Crews are at the scene, extinguishing fires, he says, and dealing with the aftermath of the attack. What was left are shells of a previous existence. The country's ability to defend itself has been hampered by America's blocking of its military aid, its intelligence, and now satellite imagery. The technology company Maxar has told the BBC that it suspended some pictures for Ukrainian accounts at the request of the White House. Defending troops had used them to identify Russian positions. One officer says it's now like fighting blind. President Trump has threatened large-scale sanctions and tariffs on Russia after its bombardments, but in the same breath, he also suggested that anyone in Vladimir Putin's position would be doing what he's doing. How Russia's invasion ends is dominating political agendas. Sir Keir Starmer is heading to Paris on Tuesday to meet defence chiefs from countries willing to send troops here after a ceasefire is signed. And despite the White House warming to Moscow and being more hostile to Kyiv, President Zelensky has been forced to mend his relationship with Donald Trump because of the reality that both Europe and Ukraine still need the military might of America. President Zelensky is due to travel to Saudi Arabia ahead of a meeting of senior Ukrainian and American officials to discuss the terms of a potential truce. Russia's demands have not softened, whereas Ukraine is being forced to compromise.
James Waterhouse. In Syria, the first major clashes between the new Islamist government and supporters of the toppled President Bashar al-Assad have taken place. Reports say hundreds of people have been killed in the Latakia and Tartus regions since the government force was ambushed on Thursday. Most of the dead are said to be civilians from the Alawite minority, some of them victims of massacres. This woman, who has friends and family there, told us what she'd been hearing. She didn't want to be identified, so one of my colleagues has voiced her comments.
One of my friends is a pharmacist whose husband was killed yesterday. And today she was shot as well while pregnant, and she's bleeding on the streets. People are in their houses, staying safe in their houses. They're not doing anything. They would come in and knock on their doors, and if they don't open, they would just spray all the house with bullets, and they would kill anybody that's in there. It's just ethnic cleansing there against Alawites in that area.
Dozens of Alawites have fled to Lebanon. From Damascus, our Middle East correspondent Lina Sinjab sent this report.
Videos and images on social media of bodies lying in the streets are causing anger among many Syrians. The coastal city of Banias is believed to have witnessed the worst violence, with women and children among those killed by forces affiliated to the new authorities. Those forces are reported to include Chechen fighters. Violence erupted after remnants of the Assad regime from the Alawite minority ambushed security and army personnel, killing dozens of them. Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Sharra, has vowed to hold anyone who attacked civilians accountable. So far, his forces seem unable to control the situation. Many of his supporters have a hardline Islamic agenda that could pose a real threat to the unity of the country.
Lina Sinjab. The United States executes dozens of people annually. But Friday was the first time for 15 years that a man was put to death by firing squad. Brad Sigmund was 67 and was executed in Columbia, South Carolina, where he'd chosen to be shot rather than being given a lethal injection or sent to the electric chair. This more than two decades after he'd confessed to murdering his ex-girlfriend's parents, battering them to death with a baseball bat. Paul Moss spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Merlin Thomas, and asked her first why Brad Sigmund had made that choice.
He was offered the alternatives of death by electric chair or death by lethal injection, but his lawyers say he chose the more violent option because he had concerns about the effectiveness of the other option. So, for example, he said that the electric chair would, and I quote, cook him alive, and he feared that the lethal injection would essentially drown him by sending a rush of fluid to his lungs. And there have been questions around the effectiveness of, say, the lethal injection, because in South Carolina itself, the three most recent cases of men who were sentenced to death by the lethal injection were declared dead after 20 minutes, but appear to stop breathing after just a few minutes. And there's also been questions around the lack of transparency in terms of the lethal injection, because there was a new law that was brought in 2023 which shielded the names of the suppliers and the exact contents of those lethal injections. And so lawyers and other critics have said that because they don't have that information, they can't properly analyse what's in the lethal injection. And it should be said that this is a really rare instance. Brad Sigmund will only be the fourth person since the country reintroduced the death penalty in 1976 to be executed by firing squad.
Well, rare, but I see that three other states have now legalized firing squads. Given that, and also those widespread difficulties you were describing about lethal injection, is there a chance we're going to see more people executed by firing squad in the US?
It's very possible. In Idaho, there was recently a bill that was passed that could make death by firing squad the primary method. And also, it's still the secondary method in several other states as well, if, for example, a lethal injection drug can't be obtained. And it is worth saying that according to a Gallup poll just last year, 53% of Americans are in favor of the death penalty of a person convicted of murder. And so it is still a majority of Americans who are still in favor of this.
Merlin Thomas. Still to come on this podcast, what the Danes think of Donald Trump's plan to take over Greenland.
I find it really scary. Everything he sees, he just wants to get everything in some kind of way.
South Korea's impeached president, Yoon Sung-yeol, has walked out of a detention centre in Seoul after being released. He'd been held on accusations of insurrection after a failed attempt to impose martial law in December. Mr. Yoon was met by huge crowds of his supporters, waving flags as he left the prison and greeted them. Mr. Yoon was released after prosecutors decided not to appeal against a court's decision to free him on technicalities. He's still suspended from duties, and his criminal and impeachment trials continue. Andrew Peach got more on this from our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie.
every day we get something I think we're not quite expecting. But look, this doesn't actually change the charges that Mr. Yoon is facing. So he is charged with insurrection. This is one of the most serious crimes that you can be charged with in South Korea, which is why he, as a sitting president, has been able to be charged with it, because presidents have immunity from most crimes. So he is still going to stand trial. It just means that he's not going to do it from behind bars. And his lawyers have been fighting all along, you see, to get him released. They've been arguing that it's illegal to keep him in custody, and the courts have agreed with them essentially on a number of legal technicalities. The prosecutors, they could have appealed this, but it seems that they're playing it safe, so they've chosen not to appeal it. This case is just so important. It's totally unprecedented. It's the first time a sitting president has ever been arrested, so there's just no legal precedent for this. There's no legal rule book, and it seems that they want to avoid any disputes that come further down the line, so that there's no doubt when this verdict comes in.
And if he's removed as president, does that change his legal status regarding the other charges that are still against him?
Well, what we could see is if he is removed as president, then it could open him up to a whole load of other charges that he hasn't been subjected to yet because of that presidential immunity, because there is a separate process that's happening here. So you've got the criminal process, but then you've also got President Yoon's impeachment process. And this is going to decide whether to permanently remove him from office. So he was suspended a couple of weeks after he declared martial law. The parliament suspended him, but the courts have to rubber stamp that. So they've been holding a trial for the last few weeks and going through the evidence, and they're going to rule just in the coming days, really. We're expecting it next week, about whether to permanently remove him from office. And yeah, that does change his status, and that could change things quite a lot. What we weren't expecting was to have him walk free before the court decided whether or not to bar him from office.
And we know he has supporters. We heard them there. But have you any sense of where the balance of public opinion is across South Korea?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, martial law lasted for 6 hours in the end, but what has been staggering is how much it has polarised this country, and we're seeing still the ground and the crisis deepen here. So still more people want to see him permanently removed from office than want to see him reinstated, but the number of people who do want to see him back has been growing, and people really... His supporters, what we see, I mean, I've been at many of these protests all along, and what I've really noticed is that they are becoming more loyal, his supporters, and more agitated. They see him as a martyr. They think that he is being mistreated, and they're out on the streets and they're celebrating because they see this as a victory. So whatever the courts decide in the coming weeks about whether to remove him from office, it is going to upset a lot of people here, and the authorities are bracing themselves for potential unrest.
Jean McKenzie. The government in the Democratic Republic of Congo has offered $5 million for anyone helping to arrest the rebel leaders who've been capturing territory in the east of the country. Last year, they were prosecuted in absentia by a military court and were given death sentences for treason. The Congolese government has also offered $4 million for the arrest of two journalists living in exile who've been critical of President Felix Tshisekedi. Africa regional editor Will Ross told me more about those being targeted.
The head of this alliance of rebel groups, Corneille Nangaa, now he used to head the country's electoral commission, which seems a very odd turn of events, but he's then gone on to head this rebel alliance, the Congo River Alliance. And within that alliance, there's the M23 group, which is backed by Rwanda. So the two leaders, Bertrand Bisimwa and Sultani Makenga, there's also a $5 million reward for information leading to the arrest of those two. As for the journalists, I mean, this kind of shows the somewhat bizarre way in which the Kinshasa government operates, because here you've got, you know, a massive rebellion in the east of the country with territory being captured, taken away from the army. You're offering $5 million for the capture of those, or the arrest of those rebel leaders, and at the same time you're saying $4 million for a couple of journalists who are in exile, who've spoken out against the president and the government, been very critical, but it seems rather odd to have the two in the same announcement.
So has the army got no chance of capturing the rebel leaders themselves?
Well, it certainly seems that the Congolese army has been pretty weak compared to the strength of this M23 rebel group, which has had backing from Rwanda, even though at times Kigali has denied that. So it seems unlikely that they would manage to capture these people themselves. And in fact, what the Kinshasa government has mainly focused on is trying to persuade the international community to put pressure on Rwanda to stop backing the M23 rather than kind of take them on head on militarily and try and retake this territory.
And Will, the Congolese government has offered the US a deal involving the country's vast mineral wealth. What do we know about that?
Yeah, these are negotiations that have been going on, we understand, involving a lobby firm. But the idea is to try and get President Donald Trump to agree to a deal that would give the United States special access to the vast mineral wealth. But Congo is a complicated country to operate in, and given all these armed groups, it's not clear that American companies would be able to come in easily and operate.
Will Ross. The people of Greenland go to the polls next week at a time when Donald Trump says he wants to take over the autonomous Danish territory. He hasn't ruled out using military force, arguing the US needs the world's biggest island for security. And then there's the minerals and rare earth metals beneath the ice. So what do the Danes think? Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek travelled to Copenhagen to judge the mood.
Well, this is La Fontaine Jazz Club. It's the oldest in town. It's often described as the best jazz club on this side of the Atlantic. It's a little corner of America here in Copenhagen. And we've come to this place at a time where, once again, President Trump is saying he wants a not-so-little chunk of Denmark in the form of Greenland, the biggest island in the world.
I find it really scary. Everything he sees, he just wants to get everything in some kind of way.
Music student Lucas is here with friends Molly and first Clara.
Mostly I get affected by this because I think Donald Trump is scary, and because we know that he's so powerful, he can affect our everyday in a lot of different ways.
This is the changing of the guard outside the Royal Palace in the heart of Copenhagen. At a time, of course, when there's been a big change in Washington, D.C. President Trump now fundamentally changing some of the relationships with America's closest allies, countries that have stood shoulder to shoulder with America for decades. And of course, Denmark is in that group. Hans Tino Hansen runs Risk Intelligence. They give advice on threats around the world. President Trump claims US control of Greenland is an absolute necessity for international security.
The Russians have increased their presence in the Arctic, that's for sure, but it's not a presence that can directly threaten the US or kind of occupy Greenland, because we're talking about more than 2 million square kilometers.
Still, Denmark has said it will spend an extra $2 billion on defence, including in the Arctic. And Hans believes security there can be bolstered without an American takeover, but with deals that restore the scope of US influence.
You can say that if you make more agreements, both on defence security, but also maybe on the economic sense and raw materials, then we are more or less going back to where we were in the 50s and 60s.
With President Trump eyeing up Greenland's mineral wealth, we've come to meet Professor Minik Rosing, one of the world's leading geologists. Professor Rosing warns that the vastness of his homeland and the lack of infrastructure are just two elements of why Greenland may not be the cash point some Americans may hope for.
The economy of extracting it is very uncertain, whereas the investment to start in extracting it is very high.
And then there's the question of who exactly would work the mineral mines.
Most people who are there already have a job, so they don't need a job in the mining industry.
So what to make of it all?
President Trump's declaration of intention to maybe take Greenland by force, it's very similar to President Putin's rhetorics when it comes to Ukraine.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen was Danish Prime Minister for most of the noughties. And then NATO Secretary General.
I don't think at the end of the day that the Americans will take Greenland by force. If they're concerned about security, they could just increase the military presence in Greenland, and we would all welcome that.
For him, ultimately, the Danes simply may not be able to do business here with a man whose view on territorial integrity is so wildly different from theirs.
Nick Beek. From Bogota to Berlin, thousands of people took to the streets on Saturday to celebrate International Women's Day. But it's not just a day to bang drums and sing. Many countries are reflecting on the fight for gender equality. In Spain, recent statistics indicate that nearly 400,000 women had reported physical or sexual violence from a past or present partner in the last 12 months. The newsroom's Madeline Drury reports.
Despite the rain in the capital, Madrid, International Women's Day marches each year in Spain are some of the world's loudest.
We are still being killed. There are many things that need to keep changing. I don't want to see the upcoming generation going through what the previous generations and even us have gone through.
The Spanish government marked the commemorative day by announcing that there will be a 50% increase in the number of judges specialising in cases of violence against women. There has been a steady rise in the rate of convictions for intimate partner violence in Spain, reaching about 80% in 2023. But a recent report from the Council of Europe said experts were concerned that the number of sentences for sexual violence remains low. They also warned that victims continue to experience secondary victimisation in judicial proceedings. This is down to challenges to their credibility, harmful stereotypes, and the need for repeated statements.
No voy a dimitir.
And a particular high-profile sexual assault case has made the debate around Spain's machismo culture dinner table conversation.
No voy a dimitir. No voy a dimitir.
I will not resign. Those were the words of a defiant Luis Rubiales, the former Football Federation president who was found guilty in February of sexual assault for kissing footballer Jenny Hermoso without her consent. Activists argue Spain has much more work to do to protect and promote women. So as protests take place across the world this International Women's Day, it's a demonstration that Spanish women are not alone.
Madeline Drury. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Rebecca Miller and the producer was Terry Egan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.